1960 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Zarbid, we are talking about the different kinds of discharge, like irregular and regular discharge. Usually irregular discharge that you defined it as istihada. According to the laws, in fact, released by Ayatollah Sistani, let me start this episode with this question that whether it is permissible or not for a lady in the state of istihada to enter a mosque. Is she allowed to enter any mosque, or even particularly, one of the most important, or maybe the most important mosque in the world of Islam, Masjid al-Nabi?
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Obviously, it is permissible for a woman in the state of istihada or irregular blood to enter a mosque, including the mosque of the Holy Prophet, which is known as Masjid al-Nabi, of course, because as long as a woman can pray, she can enter any holy places, and she is allowed to enter a mosque, to pause in a mosque, to halt, to stay. And there's no difference in the mosque, all in any mosque, whether it is a local mosque or whether it is the holiest mosque, including the mosque of the Prophet, which you named. Now, she can recite the Holy Quran, and she can engage in any kind of religious activities which a normal woman can, you know. But we should know, our dear sisters should understand the fact that there is a difference between istihada and haid. Of course, istihada means the irregular blood which a woman discharges off and on sometimes, of course. And haid is the regular monthly period. Obviously, in the state of haid, a woman is not allowed to do any of these. She cannot enter a mosque. She cannot touch the script of the Holy Quran, and she cannot recite the verses which contain the obligatory sajda, and she cannot, of course, enter the Masjid al-Nabi in Masjid al-Haram, of course, the Kaaba, of course. It is absolutely forbidden for a woman in the state of menstruation, monthly period, to enter those two holy mosques, Masjid al-Nabi in Masjid al-Haram, of course. Those are the two holiest places. Now, in the state of nifas, all of those acts are permissible.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Sheikh Zarbid, if a woman discharges fluid, yellowish fluid.
Yes.
All right. Does she have to count it as istihada or anything else?
Yellowish fluid does not mean that it is blood, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a kind of yellowish blood fluid, but it may not be mixed with blood.
Yes.
And of course, a woman can see it for herself. If she knows that there is no blood in the fluid, then that fluid is not considered to be istihaza. Okay?
Yes.
She can just wash herself, and she doesn't need to take any other action. She is not supposed to perform one wudu for every single prayer. But if it is mixed with blood, of course, mm-hmm. then of course she has to act according to the rules of istihaza. She should follow the rules of istihaza depending on the amount of blood. If the amount is little, she has to follow the rules of qalil istihaza. If the amount is medium, she has to follow the rules of mutawassita istihaza. And then the next one, which is excessive istihaza. So depending on the type and the quantity of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker at the studio. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, some women discharge yellowish or brownish fluid before or after the regular monthly period. Then what are the Islamic laws about this? How should women go about them?
Well, there's a difference between yellowish or brownish fluid that that a woman discharges before the regular monthly bleeding or after the monthly bleeding, which is called haiz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the yellowish blood or the yellowish fluid or the brownish fluid appears before the monthly period, then according to Ayatollah Sistani, that yellowish or brownish fluid is not considered to be a part of haiz. It's not considered to be a part of the regular monthly period.
Mm.
So, but if it is discharged after the regular bleeding, for example, a woman discharges yellowish blood on the 6th day or on the 5th day or on the 7th day, the blood which is discharged or the yellowish fluid which is discharged until the 10th day of the haiz is considered to be part of the regular monthly blood,
mm-hmm.
you know, until the 10th day. And so it is there's a difference between discharging blood before the regular monthly period or after. The yellowish fluid which comes after the regular bleeding is considered to be part of the haiz, but if it appears or it is discharged before the regular menstrual period, it is not considered to be part of the haiz.
Sheikh, so what about the blood observed, in fact, in or during pregnancy for a woman? Is this istihaza or something else?
Well, people are under the impression that when a woman becomes pregnant, then she no longer sees the menstrual blood. She
mm-hmm.
no longer gets that period, the monthly period. And therefore, if a woman discharges blood, they think that this is not the blood of haiz. Well, it's not the case. And the Islamic Sharia says that a woman who is pregnant can still menstruate. She can have the menstrual discharge. Okay,
mm-hmm.
she can have the monthly period. So, depending on the amount and the the amount of blood. If a woman, a pregnant woman, discharges blood for 3 days or more, for let's say for up to 10 days, the blood which she discharges, even if she is pregnant, that blood is considered to be the blood of Hayz. It's called menstrual discharge, menstrual blood. But if it is less than 3 days, then that is considered to be istihal.
I see. Sheikh Javid, can women in their menses or even in the state of istihadah recite the Holy Quran?
Obviously, in the state of istihadah, a woman can do all acts of worship, including reciting the Holy Quran, praying, fasting, performing hajj, circumambulating, and all of these activities are allowed in the state of istihadah.
Even the verses that necessitate prostration?
Yeah, of course, she is allowed to do, because when she can pray, she can also recite the Holy Quran. Okay. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the monthly regular monthly period or bleeding, of course, a woman who is menstruating and who is discharging menstrual blood cannot recite those verses of the Quran which include the obligatory sajda. Unlike Ayatollah Sistani, other religious authorities are of the view that a woman cannot recite the whole chapter. The whole chapter. But Ayatollah Sistani says no, she can recite the chapter, but she cannot recite those verses. Those verses. Many religious scholars, as far as I know, are of the view that she cannot even recite one letter from that chapter, which includes an obligatory sajda. But Ayatollah Sistani is not of that view. He says that she can recite the whole chapter except that verse which includes sajda wajib or an obligatory sajda.
Okay, maybe I can ask you this one last quick question, Sheikh Javid.
Yes.
Well, can women in their, let's say, state of istihadah, or even the state of hayz,
sure,
wear precious stones with rings, necklaces, or gold ornaments on which some of the holy names have been engraved?
You're right. Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's permissible for a woman who is in the state of istihaza or hayz or nifas to wear all of these gold ornaments, even if they are even if holy names are engraved on them. But it's not necessary, it's not permissible, of course, it's not permissible for a woman to touch those names. You see, touching those names is absolutely forbidden.
I see.
But if she's wearing, and if the names happen to touch her body, there's no problem. She cannot use her hands to touch those names.
I see.
Okay. Because the necklace is there, and she's wearing what they call it, locket or something. I'm not sure. The name is there, and it's hanging there. It touches her body, there's no problem because she's not doing it deliberately, but she cannot touch the name using her fingers or hands.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illa hum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun basir. لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن. لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Minutes. think that he does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
When it comes to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, people usually talk about the crimes the regime has committed in this land. But Israel couldn't destroy the Palestinian people's homeland if it didn't have the support of Britain. The sad story of the occupation and its concomitant sufferings dates back to over 100 years ago. In 1916, once Britain's Prime Minister, then the Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, promised Palestine to the Jewish community in Britain. Then, on November 2, 1917, he made it official in the form of a letter addressed to the leader of the Jewish community and a member of the Zionist movement in Britain, Walter Rothschild. At the time, Britain was not even in control of Palestine, as it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. Either way, Palestine was never Balfour's to transfer so casually to anyone else. The letter, known as the Balfour Declaration, marked the beginning of the occupation of Palestine.
A group of Zionists met in London in 1917 on July the 17th to draft the formula for a declaration to be made by the British government that would in fact provide the underpinnings and the justification for Jewish immigration to Palestine and the creation of a national homeland. And so on July 17th, the Zionist organization completed work that it had been working on for a long time and drafted a declaration which was to be forwarded on to the British government. The British government then spent 4 or 5 months debating the formula for the declaration, slightly adjusted it, and issued it at the beginning of November in 1917.
When the intentions of the British and their rapport with the Zionists became too apparent, Palestinians started to protest, a kind that has never ceased, over a century later. The reason is, of course, too apparent, since the horrific consequences of British colonialism and the eventual complete Zionist takeover of Palestine are still felt after all these years. Paltry attempts to pacify Palestinian anger were to no avail, especially after the League of Nations Council in July 1922 approved the terms of the British Mandate for Palestine. It came without consulting the Palestinians, who would disappear from the British and international radar only to reappear as negligible rioters, troublemakers, and obstacles to the joint British-Zionist colonial concoctions. Despite occasional assurances, the British intention of ensuring the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state in Palestine was becoming clearer with time. The Balfour Declaration was hardly an aberration, but had indeed set the stage for the full-scale ethnic cleansing that followed decades later.
We are here in the neighborhood, the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. We come here every week and to say no to the occupation, no to apartheid, no to ethnic cleansing. The Israeli government is planning to deport the indigenous people, Palestinian people, from their home in order to evacuate it for settlers, for Jewish settlers, for colonialists.
After World War II, the UK appeared as less influential in the international arena compared to what it used to be. However, it continued to support Israel in every possible way. In November 1967, after the Six-Day War, Britain co-authored the UN Resolution 242, which could have led to a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, it did very little to insist on its implementation as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. While many might argue that Britain has been more vocal towards Israeli crimes against Palestinians, London has taken no real action to condemn Israel for the crimes it commits in the occupied territories. For example, Britain could have issued a symbolic apology in 2017 on the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. It could have been a moment of reckoning for Britain, but it was not. Instead, the government of then Prime Minister Theresa May celebrated the occasion with Israeli authorities. In the meantime, the British government continues to advocate for the so-called two-state solution, a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. But in reality, it's only protecting the interests of the Israelis.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, 3 years ago, on the 9th of November 2011, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Richmondshire, then Foreign Secretary, told this House, and I quote, "The United Kingdom judges that the Palestinian Authority largely fulfills criteria for United Nations membership, including statehood." And he added, and again I quote, "We reserve the right, we the United Kingdom, reserve the right to recognise a Palestinian state bilaterally at a moment of our choosing and when it can best help bring about peace." Mr. Deputy Speaker, that moment is now. I urge honourable members on all sides to support this amendment.
What we want is to see an Israel that is at peace with its neighbours. And I should remind you that the policy of our government is for a two-state solution, which is what we want to achieve and hope to help to bring about in a modest and humble way.
In fact, every time Palestine was getting close to claiming its rights, the UK came forward and stalled the process. When asked for clarification on the question of Palestinian statehood, then UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab sent a letter to the Balfour Project reiterating an old position. The British government will recognize a Palestinian state at a time when it best serves the objective of peace.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting leaders on all sides in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, President Abbas, obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Ashkenazi. And look, I'm here because we are a strong friend of Israel, but we also feel very strongly that we want to see a peaceful two-state solution. We've got the ceasefire. The question is now how we can build on that, bed that in, avoid any further escalations and try and find a track towards a two-state solution.
In just another example, back in April 2021, UK opposed the ICC investigation, saying it does not accept that the ICC has jurisdiction in this instance, partly since Palestine is not a sovereign state. Needless to say, the two-state idea is completely rejected by Palestinians, since they know all too well that none of the Western countries that talk about such a solution are on their side. That said, the resistance movement insists, as the only viable solution, on a public referendum participated in only by those who have roots in the land. Britain still talks about the so-called solution, but in reality, Israel has already killed the idea, trying to become a full-blown apartheid regime with international blessing. The support that Israel gets from Britain is not limited to these policies. In December 2020, Britain and Israel signed a military cooperation agreement.
Battle tested on civilian populations around the world. Today is specifically a Stop Arming Israel Day because our government licenses weapons to a regime which is occupying a people and is using those weapons against the people, as we've seen over the last year, against ordinary people marching for freedom in Gaza.
There are also huge arms deals between the two as well. The UK has bought £46 million worth of military equipment from Israeli arms firm Elbit in the past 4 years. British soldiers have also been stationed in Israel since day one of the occupation. They give the Israelis military advice and training. The ties between Britain and Israel are so tight that the UK can never have an impartial stance when it comes to the Palestine issue, no matter who occupies the number 10 in Downing Street. Yet this unholy alliance has been at the expense of the Palestinian people, who have been geographically fragmented between refugee camps, in the diaspora, militarily occupied, and treated as second-class citizens in a land their ancestors dwelt since time immemorial.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام تكلموا تعرفوا فإن المرء مخبوء تحت لسانه.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Speak so that you may be known, since man is hidden under his tongue."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find in the historical texts that the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, was truly a comprehensive persona, and it was a persona who was modeled after the persona of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. We find that one of the living miracles of the Holy Prophet was Lady Fatima Zahra, peace and blessings upon her, and of course Imam Ali, his successor and the first divinely appointed Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. And we find that this persona is truly a beautiful persona. But how can you gauge a person's persona, a person's character and personality? Well, one of the ways is via their actions, and another way is via their words. And what we see in the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them, the divinely appointed Imams, is that their words and their actions were united and in unison with one another. They were inseparable. They said what they did, and they did what they said. Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about a certain kind of a individual. He talks about this idea of the difference between two individuals
Of course, as Islam says, the difference or the superiority from one human being to another human being is not race or religion or ethnicity or nationality or color or social status or place of birth, etc. Everybody is equal. The superiority comes when we talk about taqwa, one who is more God-conscious, one who is more pious, one who follows and obeys the laws of Allah more, the one who is the best servant and slave and creation of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And so along these lines, Imam Ali says that one who has redeemed himself and then set free is never like one who sells himself and then sets himself free. Now sure, you and I both, we kind of have to think twice about what was said. And to be honest, I think even if we think twice about it, it wouldn't make too much sense. And perhaps Imam Ali knew that what he just said was so profound that people like myself would not be able to understand. So then he continues and he gives a misdaq. He gives an instance of, he gives an example of this situation. He says, that is one who with praiseworthy deeds has redeemed himself from hell is never like one who, because of sins and blameworthy acts, has surrendered his soul to hell. We must be very careful, dear friends, and we must try our best to increase our praiseworthy deeds, and we must try our best to reduce the sins that we commit. And if for some reason we do end up committing sins, we should ask Allah, the Merciful, the Forgiving, to forgive us so that none of us, God forbid, have to be surrendered to hell. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
كل صبح وكل شراب أيام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاب أيام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Yet importantly, when Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen was 12 or 13 years of age, the Quran reveals what says, وَأَنذِرْ عَشِيرَتَكَ الْأَقْرَبِينَ. Go and announce Islam now after 2 years or 3 years of relative concealment. Now it's time to announce. Amir al-Mu'mineen comes. The Prophet of Islam says to him, I'm going to invite Quraysh, the heads of Quraysh. I'm going to invite them in the house of your father Abu Talib. I'm going to ask you to cook for them. 40 people, 12, 13 years of age. Ya Ali, you go and prepare the food. This is found in Sunni and Shia narrations. Amir al-Mu'mineen at this tender age takes and seizes this opportunity. This responsibility given to him with honor. Bala, Ya Rasulullah, I will do it. He goes. The narration says Amir al-Mu'mineen is trying to prepare the food and the Prophet of Islam comes. Yes, he places some of his sacred saliva within the food and places his hands and stirs it. When the people came, the heads of Quraysh came, Ali ibn Abi Talib would serve them the food. At this young age, the food was not enough for 40 by looking at it. But they all ate and ate, and the food would look as though it was untouched. And people gathered. Question, the Prophet of Islam giving this responsibility to a 12, 13 year old, what does this mean to you and I? Ali ibn Abi Talib seizing this opportunity, what does it mean to you and I? It refers to the beautiful concept of initiative and giving responsibility. Meaning that the Prophet of Islam recognized that as far as youngsters and our youth is concerned, we need to empower them. We need to give them encouragement. We need to facilitate for them and tell them, go. Come on, you can achieve, you can become successful, you can serve, you can achieve greatness. When they feel this sense of belonging, when they feel a sense of dignity, Amir al-Mu'mineen felt this sense of honor that he was serving Rasulullah. When someone would come and praise him, he would say, Ana abdun min abidi Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. I am a servant from the servants of Rasulullah. This was the honor for Ali ibn Abi Talib. Today when we face these challenges that, for example, our youth face in many different places around the world, when they feel, or many of the communities feel, that they're not necessarily taking part, or they're not engaging, or they're not necessarily attending, or they're not interested in faith or taking part in the religion or activities associated with the religion, I guess one lesson we can take from this is that we have to facilitate and somehow encourage groups of our youth and individuals with potential to seize the opportunity and to build by providing them what is necessary in order to enhance themselves as well as activities within the community. I tell you, the Prophet of Islam utilized this throughout his holy life. You know, when it came to sending an individual towards Medina, who did he send? Mus'ab ibn Umair. Mus'ab was young. Mus'ab would belong to aristocratic family, family which was very wealthy, selling perfume. Rasulullah said, you go to Medina, Yathrib, and invite people towards the religion. He was very young. He came into Medina. He started to read the Quran. Some say he was 20, 21 years of age. When he began to read the Quran, people walked past. They were mesmerized by the words of Allah. They became Muslim. Some of them threw themselves in the well so that they purify themselves before going home, because they said, we want to become Muslim right now. They were inspired by a young man. That's why the Prophet of Islam came to Medina and it was prepared for him. The groundwork was started by a youth. And you see that even towards the end of the life of the Prophet of Islam, when he is about to leave this world, he has a huge army to go and fight the Roman Byzantines, to seek revenge over the death of many Sahaba and the battle of Mu'ta. So what does he do? He appoints a man by the name of Usama ibn Zayd ibn Haritha, the son of his adopted son. Yes, Usama ibn Zayd. He was 19 or 20 years of age. He says to him, you become the leader. To the extent that some of the companions were in their 50s and 60s, came to the Prophet and said, Ya Rasulullah, you're making a 20-year-old commander over us? I should be in charge. I am the one who's older. I am the one who's wiser. Prophet of Islam, according to Shahristani in Al-Milal wal-Nihal, the famous book, yes, he comes and says what? He says, لَعَنَ اللَّهِ مَنْ تَخَلَّفَ عَنْ جَيْشِ أُسَامَ. Whomsoever does not go on the army of Usama, Allah's mercy, it was drawn from them.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
من یه خاطره از یه آقای ژاپنی خواندم خیلی جالبه برای شما بگم. تو این
Once I was reading an article about a Japanese scientist by the name of Nakamura who had converted to the religion of Islam. His conversion to Islam was because of one of his Muslim friends who introduced Islam to him, and upon further research, Nakamura accepted to embrace Islam. Nakamura had two daughters who were students at the University of Tokyo. He really liked to ask his daughters to convert to Islam too, but he didn't know how to do it. He asked his Muslim friend, who was an engineer, to talk to his daughters and explain a little about Islam.
یکی از دخترای من گفت که اول شما ببینم نظر این قرآن شما راجع به زن چیه.
During his dialogue with Nakamura's daughters, one of them asked, "What is Quran's view about women?" In answer, Nakamura's Muslim friend read Ayah 35 of Surah Al-Ahzab, which states, "Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the faithful men and the faithful women, the obedient men and the obedient women, the truthful men and the truthful women, the patient men and the patient women, the humble men and the humble women, the charitable men and the charitable women, the men who fast and the women who fast, the men who guard their private parts and the women who guard, the men who remember Allah greatly and the women who remember Allah greatly. Allah holds in store for them forgiveness and a great reward." Only 1 week after this event, both of Nakamura's daughters converted to Islam. Why? Because upon further research and contemplation upon this ayah of the Quran, they understood that in the eyes of Allah, both men and women are equal in terms of value. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Scientists in Brazil have come up with a creative way to shore up the population of a majestic species of monkeys in danger of extinction. Brazilian conservationists have constructed a bridge to reconnect the two sides of Rio de Janeiro's Atlantic forest. The road had effectively isolated a group of lion tamarins, but now it offers hope for the endangered monkey. There are only 2,500 golden tamarins left in the wild, all of them in Brazil. It is estimated that these animals have lost more than 95% of their habitat.
As people around the globe are preparing for the New Year holidays, the Vatican lights up a Christmas tree and nativity scene set up on St. Peter's Square. People gathered around the square waiting for long hours to see the illumination. Even heavy rain did not stop them. That's while the official lighting ceremony was held inside the Paul VI Hall, where Pope Francis presides his weekly audiences. The nativity scene, made of more than 30 pieces, is created by Peruvian artists. The majestic Christmas tree is about 28 meters and comes from Andalo, northern Italy. The locals see the stunning tree as a symbol of hope and peace. The tree will be switched on every night until January the 6th.
Childhood joy and lightness meet with art at a first-of-its-kind museum in Rome, Italy. Here, all kinds of art decorations are made of balloons. The exhibit dubbed Let's Fly displays a broad range of interactive artworks. In one installation, visitors are invited to find their inner child by diving into a pool of hundreds of small balloons. In another section, giant inflatable sculptures double as a playground for kids. Some installations move only by riding a bicycle. The museum is a place where artists and spectators coexist for a journey into a world of inflatable art capable of freeing the imagination of all ages.
It's the combination of art with childhood and adolescence that makes this place so magical. So they are art installations, but also games. The blurred line between the two is what makes the museum so unique.
The balloon exhibit incorporates innovative works created by 14 different artists from across Europe. The artifacts were created using hundreds of thousands of biodegradable balloons. Organizers say they want to increase environmental awareness by being eco-friendly, as all the artworks will be reused or recycled. The exhibit will run until March the 5th.
Chinese students receive a science lesson on their country's space station, and they are lucky enough to receive it firsthand from the astronauts living in the first and core module of the station. The class was held via a live broadcast shown on the state television. The three astronauts gave a lecture that focused on physics. They explained how the weightlessness environment affects the movement of objects. The astronauts also gave a tour of the station they arrived at in October for a six-month stay. It seems that their teachings were quite motivating. The students peppered their instructors with questions, including those about living conditions in space. China launched its space station in April and plans to complete it by the end of the next year. Christmas is just around the corner, and children are waiting for their presents. In Guatemala, Santa Claus has a new mode of transport to give gifts to children with cancer.
Today, as in the past year, we are celebrating Christmas with the cancer patients of the shelter. Santa Claus came in a helicopter to give presents to the children. It is very emotional for the children. The majority of them have never been so close to a helicopter, let alone Santa Claus.
That was an exciting experience for the children. The charity event was organized by an institute that supports cancer patients for remote areas in Guatemala. The institute says the event aimed to help the children go through their therapies with more ease. The Amazon River turtles are in danger of extinction, but environmentalists have come up with an initiative to save their lives. And that's by protecting their eggs. Climate change and human activities against their ecosystem have been putting these creatures at risk. Now, what the biologists and local volunteers do is that they recover the turtle nests from riverbanks during the rainy season to protect them from drowning. Then they take care of the baby turtles until they develop a hard shell and are ready to start their life journey. Batches of tiny turtles release into a river in the Amazon border between Bolivia and Brazil. They are now grown enough to protect themselves against different threats. Environmentalists have been doing this for more than 20 years, saving millions of baby turtles. This time they released 1 million of the little turtles. During the Christmas season, people around the world love to add a dose of joy in the form of Santas. Children especially feel ecstatic to see Santas distributing presents and snacks. But you will be amazed to see how one Santa this time dives into water to give well-behaved sharks and fishes their goodies. In Malta's National Aquarium, Scuba Claus, helped by an elf, plunges into a huge fish tank with his sack of treats to feed sharks and fishes. Santas ho 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 come out in bubble from through his snorkel over his white beard. The aquarium, located in the northern part of the island, hosts more than 175 different species of various marine animals.
Butterflies are probably the most popular among all insect species on Earth due to their beauty and color. Millions of monarch butterflies have flocked to a Mexican forest, creating a magical sight, drawing tourists, scientists, and locals there. The monarch butterflies flee the cold winters of Canada and northern United States and travel thousands of kilometers to hibernate and reproduce in the temperate woods of central Mexico. Hundreds of trees crowded with butterflies can be seen along Mexico's 13,000-hectare monarch reserve after their long journey. However, experts warn of a drop in the number of the species. Climate change is reported to have had an impact on their butterflies' migration pattern, as well as a reduction in their milkweed breeding habitat in the United States.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
With the Christmas season in full swing, hundreds have gathered on Spain's Gran Canaria island to watch stunning sand sculptures representing the birth of Christ. 8 sand artists from around the world have created these spectacular figures. It took them a week to complete the scenes. A huge sand wall is built around the sculptures to protect them. The island has been holding the event every year since 2006. The warm temperatures on the Spanish beach have helped attract a lot of visitors over Christmas. According to the organizers, at least 200,000 people have visited the exhibition in the past 15 years. A joyful day at an Australian zoo as a baby pygmy hippo is born. That's good news for the zoo staff.